Je m'appelle François Shenfield, je suis médecin de la reproduction à Londres, à University College London, et je suis aussi assez active dans la Société européenne de reproduction Lécheret. Et nous nous sommes intéressés, bien sûr, à la grossesse pour autrui depuis très longtemps, et j'ai eu la joie de travailler avec Virginie plusieurs fois, avec plusieurs personnes dans cette audience aussi. So now I'm going to speak in English because I think
vous
allez parler en français. But I think our first speaker is in English. Is it you? Et c'est avec grand plaisir que j'accueille Madame Olavarria, oui. Qui vient du Mexique, si je ne me trompe. Oui. Et nous allons donc passer, je crois, au moins 3 continents cet après-midi. 3 continents plus, I don't know whether Europe counts anymore or not, but however. Thank you, so the floor is yours.
Merci beaucoup. Et cette communication est le produit d'une enquête qui s'est déroulée de juin 2015 à septembre 2016. La polémique dont il est question se poursuit, mais pour des raisons de rédaction et de traduction, nous n'en rendons compte que jusqu'à fin septembre 2016. Introduction. En mars 2016, pour la première fois au niveau de l'État fédéral, un projet de loi du Sénat mexicain a régulé l'usage des techniques de procréation médicalement assistée, PMA, y compris celle concernant la gestation pour autrui. Cette mesure a mis fin à 18 ans de pratiques légales, mais sans régulation explicite de ce procédé de gestation pour autrui dans l'État de Tabasco, un des 32 États du Mexique. Cette communication analyse le tournant qui a eu lieu entre 2015 et 2016 dans la pratique de la gestation pour autrui au Mexique à partir des voix de ces acteurs, les médecins, les législateurs et les gestatrices. Par ailleurs, cette communication s'interroge sur le sens de ce tournant et sur ses conséquences. Première partie. Le contexte avant le projet de loi. En 1997, la modification de 2 articles du Code civil de l'État de Tabasco a rendu possible la GPA qui a alors été proposée à des parents d'intention de toute nationalité, âge et orientation sexuelle, ainsi qu'une large gamme de services de PMA. Les opérations étaient effectuées indistinctement à Mexico ou à Villahermosa, capitale de l'État de Tabasco, où l'infrastructure médicale était garantie du moment que l'enregistrement des naissances se faisait dans l'État de Tabasco. À ce réseau de cliniques et d'urgence s'est ajouté le pôle touristique de Cancun, en se rendant ainsi le Mexique dans le circuit international de la GPA. Jusqu'à fin et 2015, la vingtaine de cliniques de fertilité situées dans la capitale de Tabasco n'agissaient pas uniquement de façon coordonnée avec leurs succursales ou leurs sièges à Mexico ou Cancun, mais offraient également des services de logement, de transport et de traduction, ainsi que des tours à Cancun ou vers d'autres destinations touristiques. Nous pouvons affirmer qu'une industrie du tourisme, de la reproduction ou de la fertilité s'est développé dans cette région du sud-est et des Caraïbes mexicaines sur la base d'une couverture aérienne étendue qui était déjà en place et davantage géopolitique que le Mexique offrait à ce moment-là face à des pays comme la Thaïlande ou l'Inde. Certaines de ces cliniques avaient leur propre programme de gestation pour autrui, c'est-à-dire un système de recrutement et de sélection qui leur permettait de mettre en contact des gestatrices potentielles avec des parents d'intention mexicains ou étrangères par les biais des psychologues et des travailleurs sociaux employés par la clinique. Depuis 2013, outre ces programmes, 2 agences d'envergure internationale avaient leur siège à Tabasco. Dans ce contexte-là, où tout était légalement possible, les médecins spécialistes en biologie de la reproduction ainsi que les propriétaires ou directeurs de cliniques ont offert des services uniquement régis par des principes éthiques individuels, le plus fréquent étant le fait d'éviter de faire coïncider les figures de la mère génétique et de la gestatrice. Nous reviendrons sur ce point dans la conclusion. L'offre des GPA a d'abord été utilisée par des usagers mexicains d'un haut niveau économique et par des célibataires ou des couples hétérosexuels et homosexuels venant des pays où la gestation pour autrui était interdite, comme l'Espagne, l'Allemagne et l'Italie. En deuxième temps, l'offre de PMA a été utilisée par des usagers de pays tels que les États-Unis et l'Argentine, attirés par de meilleures offres en termes de coûts et de facilités pour voyager. C'est alors qu'a été mis en place un système mêlant contact personnel et usage d'Internet destiné à faire savoir que la GPA était une activité rémunérée possible pour un secteur de femmes mexicaines de classe moyenne populaire ayant une scolarité niveau bac ou universitaire, la plupart étant mariées et ayant des enfants. En effet, si un nombre significatif de gestatrices participant à notre enquête a été victime de déplacements provoqués par la violence sévissant dans certaines régions du Mexique, ou si certains d'entre elles sont des migrants d'origine centra-américaine ou sud-américaine, voyant dans la gestation pour autrui un complément économique sur le chemin des États-Unis, le profil des gestatrices ne correspond pas aux clichés fournis par la presse ni par les groupes législatifs qui ont provoqué la pénalisation de la GPA en 2015. Par ailleurs, si les connaissances techniques qui possèdent les gestatrices sur les questions médicales et juridiques relatives à la GPA, la plupart de celles que nous avons interrogées ont exercé la surrogation de leur utérus sous le couvert d'un contrat rédigé par un juriste, les avocats constituent des acteurs décisifs, qu'ils soient employés par les cliniques agences ou qu'ils conseillent leurs clientes dans l'exercice indépendant de leur profession. En effet, ce sont eux qui définissent les termes selon lesquels se réalise la gestation, l'accouchement et la remise de l'enfant, ainsi que l'établissement des prestations et des contre-prestations entre parents d'intention clinique et gestatrice. À cet égard, les juristes interrogés ont manifesté leur consensus sur les aspects suivants. La nécessité de remplir les vides légaux qui ont généré des abus supposés de la part des cliniques, tout comme d'éviter l'exploitation des femmes. D'autres éléments tels que le statut des cellules germinales et de l'ovule fécondé restent jusque maintenant dans une zone d'ombre ou d'indétermination. Ainsi, les conditions dans lesquelles les gestatrices développent leur activité dans l'État du Tabasco durant cette période peuvent être considérées identiques à celles d'un travail informel. La plupart des gestatrices interrogées se sont montrées disposées à recommencer et ont même encouragé leurs sœurs, parents et amis à les imiter. Si elles sont mariées, leurs époux doivent renoncer à la paternité par un jugement légal et elles conservent leur droit à une interruption légale de la grossesse avant la 12e semaine. Deuxième partie, la polémique. Entre 2014 et 2015, plusieurs cas de citoyens espagnols bloqués au Mexique parce qu'ils ont été dans l'impossibilité d'obtenir le passeport de leurs enfants nés des gestatrices mexicaines ont été mentionnés par la presse mexicaine et une série de reportages journalistiques ont été transmis à une large audience. Le thème de la GPA dans l'État du Tabasco est devenu le centre d'une polémique médiatique, législative et de l'opinion publique dont les acteurs ont exprimé des postures allant de l'interdiction et la pénalisation à la régulation sous forme de lois ou de normes officielles. Parmi les premières, on rencontre des groupes religieux ou para-religieux associés à l'activisme anti-avortement qui ont participé très activement dans des documents et des campagnes d'un groupe appelé « Exploitation des femmes à des fonds reproductifs ». Des membres de religions évangéliques et des témoins de Jéhovah qui s'opposent à des pratiques concernant des processus corporels et génétiques. L'archevêque catholique porte-parole de la religion majoritaire au Mexique, ne s'est pas manifestée ouvertement contre la GPA, mais la critique. Dans les partis politiques, il y a des tendances à la fois vers les deux pôles, interdiction versus régulation, indépendamment de l'affiliation politique de l'extrême droite à l'extrême gauche. Troisième partie. Effet du projet de loi d'avril 2016 et du projet de loi en cours de vote sur les acteurs de la PMA. Le tournant provoqué par le projet de loi du Sénat de l'État fédéral, approuvé le 26 avril 2016, se traduit tout d'abord par l'exclusion des non-Mexicains, des personnes de plus de 40 ans et de celles qui n'ont pas de diagnostic médical d'infertilité, de l'accès à la GPA. Il s'attaque aussi aux urgences de substitution qu'il interdit. Ce projet interdit la présence d'intermédiaires dont la pratique est alors pénalisée, alors que ce même intermédiaire, il y a moins d'un an, coordonnait la participation des gestatrices et des donneuses d'ovules au niveau régional, national et international. Résultats et conclusions. Nous présenterons ici deux résultats d'arrivée de l'expérience mexicaine de gestation pour autrui. Le premier se base sur les constats empiriques enregistrés ethnographiquement que jamais la gestatrice par substitution n'apporte l'ovule. Cela signifie que quand la GPA ne constituait pas encore une pratique illégale, une femme ayant un lien génétique avec l'embryon à l'origine de la grossesse n'a jamais cédé l'enfant à des parents d'intention. Alors que le Code civil de l'État du Tabasco permettait qu'une mère de substitution soit aussi la donneuse d'ovules, une telle restriction a obéi à des critères que se sont imposés tant les médecins et les avocats que les gestatrices. Dans nos enquêtes, les gestatrices ont exprimé leur refus de céder un enfant génétique, tout comme de donner leur ovule. Nous postulons donc que dans les cas mexicains, des facteurs culturels et des systèmes de croyances ont opéré au-delà des législations et des régulations, en établissant un seuil éthique dans l'exercice de la GPA. Le deuxième résultat est que le tournant dans la loi au niveau national s'est traduit principalement par un détour géographique au niveau global. Les acteurs politiques ont exprimé leur refus de présenter une image du Mexique identique à celle de la Thaïlande ou l'Inde, qui autorisait les pratiques de GPA. Ils ont voulu montrer que le Mexique est une nation développée qui les interdit comme la France ou l'Espagne, ou qui les régule comme le Canada et les États-Unis. Cependant, cela n'a pas mis un point final à la participation du Mexique dans l'industrie de la PMA, qui est une question structurelle de bioéconomie mondiale, comme l'ont montré les témoignages obtenus dans nos enquêtes. Dans les forums sur Internet qu'il y a encore quelques mois captés l'intention des femmes mexicaines, il est demandé aujourd'hui d'avoir un visa pour les États-Unis et la disponibilité de voyager en Californie. Une telle demande réduit sérieusement le nombre de gestatrices possibles. Une fois abandonné le paradis reproductif qu'a représenté l'État de Tabasco jusqu'à 2015, le circuit du tourisme de la fertilité au Mexique s'est déplacé vers des cliniques récemment installées dans d'autres lieux touristiques du pays comme Puerto Vallarta, sur la côte pacifique, qui font profil bas en ce qui concerne le recrutement des gestatrices potentielles. Le processus se réalise maintenant entre Mexico et Puerto Vallarta, place touristique largement connectée avec la côte ouest des États-Unis et du Canada, vers lesquelles se dirigent les gestatrices. Si pour elles l'offre d'emploi s'est considérablement réduite en interdisant la GPA à des parents d'intention étrangère, le montant de la paie a été multiplié de 10 à 15 000 à 30 000 dollars américains. Car depuis avril 2016, elles doivent accoucher en Californie et États-Unis. Comme le site d'Internet actuel annonce, surrogacy in Mexico is better than ever. Surrogacy in Mexico is now restricted, but not over. Nous considérons que ce détour répond à des lois du marché au niveau national et mondial, mais ne répond pas au type de participation d'un pays émergent comme le Mexique dans ce marché global. Nous voulons dire là que le Mexique ne fournit pas seulement de force de travail aux États-Unis avec ses migrants, mais qu'il participe aussi comme pourvoyeur de force de travail reproductif. La loi approuvée par le Sénat n'a pas pu contrôler les tendances du marché global qui poursuivent leur développement. Au fond, ce n'est un tournant radical que pour le Mexique. Les parents d'intention et les médiateurs du monde entier persisteront dans leur projet. Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. Je vous demande à tous de garder vos questions pour après les autres prestations, puisque nous aurons un débat. Et maintenant, nous allons vous écouter. Et je crois que vous nous parlez de la situation. English, about the Swedish situation.
No, not really.
No,
but never
about
mind.
People who leave. Okay.
I can introduce myself.
Okay.
So, thank you very much. Well, I work from a cultural studies perspective on understanding media text as social and cultural practices. And in this case, I analyze weblogs and documentaries, and I question how kinship is mediated and formed in a globalized world. In this presentation, I wish to focus on three well-known documentary film productions, each with a distinct point of view on the phenomena of transnational assisted reproduction and surrogacy in India. A Mother's Dream has the perspectives of surrogate mothers as a primary point of departure. Made in India represents the intended parent's point of view, and Google Baby develops from the perspective of an intermediary person who makes business by connecting the international intended parents with fertility clinics, egg donors, and surrogates. I argue that these are narratives that provide us not only with critical views on privilege within the stratified structure of transnational assisted reproduction, but they also contain and express ambivalences and contradictions that shape our understanding of surrogacy and makes obvious that this is a complex phenomena with no simple and easy answers. I suggest a theoretical framework to speak and understand the phenomenon within, and I want to focus on neoliberalism in this case and on respectability. In a neoliberal setting, the individual is understood as being in charge of his or her own life and body parts and in the position to take responsibility for getting the most out of the opportunities available. Ivar Ong suggests an understanding of neoliberalism with a small n, an emerging logic of governing that travels not as a system but as a migratory set of practices. Transnational surrogacy fits this neoliberal logic that travels to emerging economies both as a technique of administration and as a metaphor. And the three documentaries display how the various stakeholders in a transnational surrogacy arrangement navigate in and negotiate these possibilities. In the documentaries, surrogacy is shown to be a part of a commercial industry with direct economic impact on a wide range of people. In Made in India, the surrogate mother frees Lisa from her infertile body. In Google Baby, Daron and other gay men gain access to parenthood through surrogacy, while Daron's mother achieves a prominent place as a grandmother. Both the gay childless man and the heterosexual childless woman are constructed as legitimate consumers in a transnational reproductive economy. But not only the infertile Westerners, also the egg donor and the Indian surrogate are understood as entrepreneurs, consciously acting on a free market. Egg donation and surrogacy also makes it possible for the US egg donor cat and the Indian surrogate mothers to take positions as modern subjects, to renovate or to buy a house and educate their children. In Google Baby, the neoliberal framework is linked with the sexual liberation of Western women. Here from the movie, the film. Here, the pill and the sexual liberation is equaled with assisted reproduction and further associated with global consumer culture. Technology frees reproduction from sex, globalization makes it economically feasible, and the credit card makes it easy. This is also evident in other scenes in Google Baby, as when Daron normalizes surrogacy as outsourcing. Made in India and Google Baby shows how individual choices are made in order to optimize the possibility of having children. In Google Baby, the egg donor, Kat, decides for herself to repeatedly sell her eggs. And in Made in India, Asia is positioned as a modern woman as she independently takes the decision of becoming a surrogate and she signs the agreement without her husband's consent. She was told that the children were going abroad, but otherwise she has not thought much about the children she carries. Her family is under economic pressure and her plan is to save the money to secure her the future of her children, especially her daughter, she tells. In a mother's dream, the surrogate mothers are aware of the danger of getting too attached to the child, and they suggest an economic frame to explain the problem. They compare their task as surrogate mothers with the investment made by the commissioning parents, as here articulated by Nisha. I take more care of this baby than my own children. Why? Because the couple is spending money, and the money shouldn't go to waste. Thus, the medically infertile woman, the homosexual man, and their assistants are presented as legitimate subjects in a multi-layered economy of reproduction that's on one hand global and at the same time situated in a local setting and adapted to the specific reality of surrogacy. The documentaries rewrite and legitimize the neoliberal framing as a recognizable liberation project, as both the childless Westerners and the citizens in India are transformed into active entrepreneurs and shaped as rational subjects who deliberately make their own choices based on the interests and opportunities they each have. However, the film narratives also allow critical views on privilege and social injustice, as the documents display the obvious opposition between the stakeholders. A Mother's Dream shows the leading doctor, Naina Patel, as she arrives to the clinic in a Mercedes, whilst the surrogates are seen in rickshaws or on the backseat of a scooter or simply walking. Google Baby tells that the cesareans in the clinics are almost always performed on a Tuesday in order to meet the schedules of the medical staff and enabling the intended parents to plan their trip. In the operating theater, the doctor efficiently cuts open the womb. Of a surrogate, whilst at the same time serving a potential customer on her mobile phone, thus not devoting full attention to the procedure. However, in a mother's dream, the doctor is also shown to communicate directly with the surrogates and express concern for their opinions and their well-being. Here she is staged as responsible and dignified as she tells the camera that the surrogate hostel was established on behalf of a wish from the surrogates themselves who required privacy around their pregnancy and that the stay in the hostel has developed into an opportunity for otherwise illiterate surrogates to educate themselves. Google Baby develops a critical view upon the motives and the emotional engagement of Doron's clients, and he positions himself as a respectable father by underlining that his own involvement in the pregnancy of his daughter was much stronger than most of his clients. Made in India establishes clear oppositions between the rather large Americans and the local Indians. Visual and verbal arguments are blended as the film questions if the rights that Lisa and Brian claim over the children are actually based on the genetic connections or rather on their economic superiority. Often the surrogates in Google Baby and A Mother's Dream are presented as passive and uninformed as they await the progress of pregnancy and the decisions made for them by other stakeholders in the clinic. And the simplicity of the surrogate's everyday reality is visualized, for instance, by the endless rotation of the fan in the ceiling and illustrated by the camera dwelling at the old flakes of paint coming off and the traditional handmade brooms used to clean the floor in the clinic. However, the surrogates also voiced their opinions. And the documentaries present them with a wide range of views on the questions of respectability and relatedness. As here quotes from A Mother's Dream. In Beverly Skeck's work on respectability as a mechanism for judging the value of a person, Skeck suggests a performative understanding of respectability as something that is done or performed in certain ways, for instance, privileging the task of mothering or caregiving. In the documentaries, the question of respectability appears as a generally ideologically charged theme, but also as a concrete issue in the rhetorical construction of both the surrogate Indian surrogate mothers and the intended parents' narratives. The affects connected to motherhood, love, desire, and hope, are used to naturalize and legitimize the choices and the actions of both surrogates and intended parents, as well as competing and conflicting interests, views, and expectations. Respectability is seen as one of the dynamic elements negotiated rhetorically in relation to the conditions of a global, flexible, and mediated world. Both for Lisa and Asya in Made in India, as well as for the surrogates in Google Baby and in A Mother's Dream, the identity of being a mother is a dominant and respectable position. Made in India shows how the paradoxical relationship between the feeling of agency or no agency, choice and no choice are negotiated. In Lisa's understanding of her own situation, she has an absence of choice, as this is her only option to have a child. She said, "I just can't imagine being without kids. I wanted to be a mother since I was about 25 years of age, and here I am turning 40. The surrogate Asya likewise uses motherhood as an argument, whilst framing her activity as a surrogate in neoliberal terms of selling or renting out her womb, she also reinstates that her concern is first and foremost as a mother. And here she refers to her children at home. In the former mentioned scene in Google Baby, a cesarean cut is performed on a surrogate whilst the doctor talks on a mobile phone. The chosen camera angle positions the surrogate as attached to the operation table as a crucified victim. In contrast to the doctor, the camera has eye contact with the surrogate and shows how tears gather in her eyes as a fair-skinned child is pushed and pulled out of her uterus. The sound of the womb being cut up, the cry of the newborn child, and the doctor's happy voice is blended with the visual impression of different bodily fluids. This scene is a disturbing narrative. Although the documentary is defined as non-fiction, here aesthetic effects are nevertheless used in order to provide affect and provoke ambivalence. And as a contrast, the next scene shows Daron's home in Israel, where he and his partner proudly presents their daughter to friends and family and shares her creation story. And thus, Google Baby pinpoints the contradictory condition of transnational assisted reproduction and to which extent parenthood has become diverse. The surrogates are at the same time presented as oppressed victims and as respectable angel-like mother figures in a fairy tale narrative, as well as stakeholders in a professional business relation. Similarly, the intended parents' narratives carry inherent tensions. The film credits of Made in India tell that one of the twin girls sadly passed away only a few months old due to sudden infant death syndrome, and the documentary in all is dedicated to her memory. The grief of having lost a child is ascribed to the intended parents and by no means to the surrogate. It is Lisa and Brian's tragic loss that is announced in the film and can be followed on their weblog. Their grief is a double grief of first being infertile and then parents of a dead child. In the film, these affects add to their credibility as parents, and in conclusion, they work by excluding the surrogate from entering into a kinship relation with the surrogate baby. Thus, respectability for both surrogates is sought and granted in relation to motherhood, however clearly conditioned by privilege. The three documentaries construct narratives that make it obvious that the agency of the Indian surrogates is constrained, privilege is stratified, and that the Indian surrogate mothers do not have the same opportunity to influence their situations as the Western childless intended parents. while the economic privileged intended parents travel across continents several times during the process, the Indian surrogates typically do not leave their local environment. Most Indian surrogates do not speak English, and they do not participate in the intended parents' internet-based communication. Analytically, the documentaries show surrogacy as a complex situation wherein different understandings of motherhood and kinship are displayed. The documentaries present transnational surrogacy in India as an unstable and emerging structure wherein surrogates and other agents have diverse and ambivalent opinions on their circumstances. By viewing transnational surrogacy through the lens of filmmakers, surrogacy is placed as interactions in time and space, and we are able to relate to them. Affect and humor is used as rhetorical strategies to both legitimize and to question surrogacy as an acceptable way of creating kinship. The film frames surrogacy as a do-it-yourself project and positions intended parents, surrogates, and donors within a liberal, neoliberal framework of understanding, however not reducible to a single logic. The documentaries portray transnational surrogacy as complex and voice how different actors reflect on and question their own position and situation. The documentaries transfer unresolved concerns for the surrogate mothers and for the changes in view of parenthood as questions for the audience to discuss and consider through the narrations and doubts of the protagonists. They call for debate, question new understandings of kinship and its impact on human relation on a global level. Thank you.
Okay, Annika, this time I'm going to be right. You are German.
Yes.
And you prefer English or French?
English.
Please. English, okay. So, German intended parents going global, where do they go to? You're going to tell us.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very happy to be part of this conference. So today I'm going to talk about my project, which has been going on since approximately 2012. So this is based on research mainly with German intended parents. So the idea of this project is that I take intended parents in Germany and also parts of Switzerland as a starting point, and I'm following them around the globe to where they go. So this is a very classical multi-sided ethnography. So what might be important to know, first of all, is the legal situation in Germany. So surrogacy wasn't always forbidden there. So in the 1980s, or the 1080s, so of course that's wrong. That's a typo. So the first commercial traditional surrogacies took place in Germany in the 1980s. And until 1988, there were actually 24 agencies for surrogacy, which... considering the fact that Germany is not such a huge country, is quite a large number. Of course, these were all traditional surrogacies. In 1987, when the Baby M case happened in the United States, and you all know about all the discussions that took place worldwide, there was also a very lively public discussion of surrogacy in Germany. And this led to a political and academic debates, which finally led to amendments made to the so-called Adoption Placement Act. And 2 years later, Germany introduced the Embryo Protection Act. So the Embryo Protection Act prohibits the fertilization of an egg cell with the aim of implanting the embryo into a woman other than the woman from whom the egg cell has originally been taken. And it also prohibits the transfer of an embryo into the uterus of a woman and a surrogate who plans to give up the child to others after its birth. Importantly, the punishment is 3 years imprisonment or a monetary fine. And doctors in Germany risk losing their license because every punishment to doctors that's more than 1 year results in a loss of their doctor's license. So the Adoption Placement Act regulates brokering of surrogacy and advertising in order to find surrogates or find intended parents. Here again, the punishment is up to 3 years and or a monetary fine. But what is really important to know is that in Germany, even though the whole procedure is illegal, neither intended parents nor surrogates are punished. So this means if people go and commission surrogacy abroad, they may get into trouble when they try to bring back the child to Germany, but they will not be punished themselves. So what are the consequences of the legal situation in Germany? As I just said, doctors risk the loss of their license. So this means that medical procedures that are necessary for a surrogacy are definitely not performed in Germany because it's just too dangerous for doctors to do so. The other thing is also there are no agencies in Germany, and even psychologists, like one of the intended parents I work with, she told me that when she was looking for a psychologist to sort of guide her during the process or to accompany her during the process of the surrogacy, that this counselor even sought legal advice first, whether she was even allowed to work to be a person psychologist who is doing a surrogacy. So people are very worried about losing their jobs or even having to go to prison. So what this means is that neither medical care nor information about surrogacy or any kind of advice are done in Germany. So what is happening is that people do these things in secret. So for example, intended mothers actually do use hormonal stimulation in order to have their egg cells removed, but they order the drugs from outside of Germany. So there's one particular pharmacy which usually sends these medications by courier to Germany, and they deliver it to your house. And the other thing is that people seek advice online because they cannot, like, go to any, they can't get any advice from official sources, so they exchange all the information online. And I think that we've seen this in many presentations today, but it hasn't really been talked about very much, that without the internet, these kinds of things would just not be possible. So especially in situations like in Germany where surrogacy is illegal and people have to go abroad, like all the information seeking and all the contact and before the surrogacy, during the surrogacy and afterwards, it all happens through the internet. So it would just not be possible. So also here, people are seeking informal advice by others, and these are mainly people who've done surrogacy before themselves. This is the advice they get. And this also leads to certain agencies and certain doctors being particularly frequently used by intended parents. There are certain agencies, for example, in the US, which explicitly employ a German-speaking staff. So they really cater to German-speaking clients. So what happens with IP, intended parents, is that, of course, they have to make use of transnational travel, reproductive travel. And I'm very critical of the term reproductive tourism. I think this has been talked about today as well. So I prefer to use the term transnational reproductive travel. Another thing that is very specific in Germany is that the practice of surrogacy and AITs in general, but surrogacies in particular, are quite stigmatized and are still very much a taboo. So even people who do IVF do not necessarily talk very much about it. Maybe it's becoming a little bit more open, but people are very aware of very harsh criticism. The public discourses are very critical. There are also some media reports which, you know, present a couple that has gone through surrogacy and it's presented in sort of sympathetic ways, but I would say that the majority of news reports and media reports are rather critical. And there are four main arguments that are made, both in public discourses and in the media, and one is the creation of designer babies. And Germany is particularly careful about these things, which of course also has something to do with the country's history. So this whole idea of euthanasia, eugenics, this kind of stuff is something people see and very or find very problematic. Then the second main argument or the second main criticism is the exploitation of women, and in this case particularly surrogates, but also egg donors. And then, like, one criticism that is also mentioned very often is the unnaturalness of surrogacy and this idea that a woman develops a very strong bond with the child she carries, and that this bond is sort of very suddenly ruptured and severed, and that this is a very unnatural way of creating a baby. And finally, of course, the commodification of babies and this suspicion of baby selling. So these are the four main points that are usually made in public discourses. And these moral regimes that are very prominent in Germany, they, of course, sort of, they influence legal regulations and the other way around. So there is this sort of threefold thing. It's the moral regimes, then the political discussions of this, and linked to this also the legal regulations. And the current coalition agreement between the Christian Democratic Party and the social democratic party. So they explicitly put in their coalition agreement that we oppose surrogacy because it's irreconcilable with human dignity. And also the German Ethics Council, they organized a conference on assisted reproductive technologies in 2014, which had one panel explicitly dealing with surrogacy. And there, too, they were very critical of surrogacy, even though they invited a few speakers who were in favor of the practice, or at least in favor of legally regulating it in a way so that it can be done in an ethically responsible way. But in general, still, the German Ethics Committee, which is also advising German politicians, is rather opposed to surrogacy, and one of their main arguments is that surrogacy is one of the assisted reproductive technologies that create what they call multiple parenthood, or what we in anthropology would rather call fragmented parenthood, so that you have several mothers or several fathers, so that you can have up to five parents in a way in surrogacy if you include egg donors and sperm donors. So what also happened recently was that if people would if a German child was born overseas, people would have to fill in a form in order to have it entered into the German registry, like birth registry. And very recently, this document was extended, and people now have to put into the document whether that child has been born through a surrogacy. And for many intended parents, this really is a major problem, because before they could sort of slip through the whole legal regulations in a way if they pretended that the child was born overseas and nobody asked. But now most of these people are really aware of the fact that this really is illegal if they cross the wrong box. So the top example says the biological mother, and then in brackets it says the one who has given birth to the child. So here in the bottom part, so these are just little pieces of the document, is has this been an adoption or a surrogacy? So people really are now forced to make a statement, and that makes it very, like, emotionally very problematic for them. So the ways to circumvent these kinds of regulations, and the main, I would say that the main destinations for their reproductive travel are the United States, India, or Ukraine. Of course, the India situation has recently changed. In Germany, the mother who has given birth to a child is the legal mother. So what people do is that if she is married, her husband is automatically also regarded to be the legal father. So the surrogate must be unmarried so that the intended father can officially be the legal father. And then his wife or his husband, if it's a homosexual relationship, does the stepchild adoption. This is a way how to circumvent the legal regulations, but the social stigma is something that people find really hard to deal with. So these are just a few points what people do in order to circumvent social stigma. So they do it secretly. They really do wear fake bellies, for example, with mock pregnancies. They go away for a so-called sabbatical and come back with a child. They relocate to a different place. They change their jobs. They make false statements in documents. And there's a very, very tiny number of people who decide to go exactly the other way around and be very offensive about these things, and that they act as like activists. But these are only very few people, and it's mainly these two. So first of all, there's the woman on the left who had cancer and who had to have a hysterectomy because of her cancer. And then she had had twins. And these two men also had had a singleton from India, and then they had twins from the US. So, but these really are exceptions. This is very rare for people to openly speak about it. So now this is my last slide. I'm almost finished. And this I promised to Laurence to use this slide. So there was one big thing that happened in 2014 that a gay couple had a child by a surrogate in the United States. And when they for several years tried to fight for the child to be entered into the German birth registry, which means German citizenship, a German passport, these kinds of things, which otherwise make your life very difficult if you don't have the appropriate documentation in Germany. And after 3 years, they were actually successful. So the court, this was the Federal Supreme Court decision, so it went up certain levels, and they decided that the well-being of the child was more important than the legal restrictions, and that the child has a right to be legally connected to the people who care for it. So this was their argument. But this was very much based on this individual situation. And even though other intended parents now use this court rule as a precedent, but it's not officially used as a precedent. So it always has to be decided on a single case basis. And I've been asked if this has really changed the way intended parents deal with their surrogacy. And as far as I know, it hasn't really. It has maybe made their legal situation a little bit easier, but the stigma and the taboo around it and the fear of losing a child or of losing custody of the child are so great that people still, like the majority of people, still do it in secrecy. And I don't think that this is going to change very much in the near future. Okay, so thank you very much.